In the coming week, the U.S. House panel's Capitol riot hearings hit an inflection point, and Hong Kong marks 25 years since the handover from Britain to Chinese control. It's June 30th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon, and today we are joined again by Carla Robbins. She's the adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and is filling in again for Jim Lindsay. Carla, thanks again for joining.
Great to be invited back.
Well, we are jumping right into one of the bigger backdrops to the late spring, early summer, which is what are known as the January 6th hearings, Carla. This is the House Select Committee that had convened to look into the circumstances behind the storming of the Capitol and what are the lasting consequences. Now, we just heard in the past week testimony from a top former White House aide, the aide to the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and her name is Cassidy Hutchinson. Carla, tell us about what is making these hearings so captivating.
So, you know, Bob, I've been obsessed with these hearings, you know, both for content and for process. You know, we're finding how chillingly close we came to losing our democracy, not just on that day, but in the days leading up to it. And the process itself is a reminder of what democracies can do that other systems won't, which is provide a transparent accounting of the misdeeds committed by even some of the most powerful leaders. And, you know, the devastating testimony has come overwhelmingly from Republicans, many of them political appointees and some of them elected official. And it shows that there are still people in Washington and throughout the country who, when push comes to shove or when a subpoena arrives, chose the rule of law and our democratic institutions above craven politics. So that's my silver lining as we get ready to celebrate Independence Day, Bob. I sort of felt that given the fact that it's going to be the July 4th weekend, we couldn't be completely grim about this. So for why these hearings have been riveting, more Watergate than Mueller or dating ourselves, Iran-Contra, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that. I think, you know, a good part of it is the new testimony when we thought we knew it all about what's happened. You know, you talked about Cass Hutchinson this week, you know, this top aide to Meadows, 25 years old, but with extraordinary inside the room access and incredible self-possession. And among her claims that Trump knew and didn't care that his supporters were armed when he urged them to march on the Capitol, that was really blockbuster stuff. We learned today that the committee has now subpoenaed the top White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, who, according to Hutchinson, pushed back hard against the idea of Trump going to the Capitol that day with the crowd, warning, according to Hutchinson, you know, quote, Mr. Trump to join the crowd of his supporters marching to the Capitol, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable. So, I mean, there's just, you know, things after things after things that people are saying in that room. Overwhelmingly Republicans that, you know, that adds a lot more texture and actually real information that we didn't have before. But beyond the witnesses, you know, the committee staff has done extraordinary research. They had an ABC News TV exec who clearly deserves credit for their use of video and a focused narrative, but they haven't turned it into, you know, it's not, you know, Disney on Ice. I mean, it's pretty restrained. And more than anything else, I think committee members have shown remarkable self-restraint. You know, Bob, you've covered a lot of these hearings. I've covered a lot of these hearings. And usual, there's this self-preening cacophony, you know, from congressperson after congressperson, you know, spending more time talking than they allow the witnesses to do. And instead, you know, they came up with this really great approach in which they have one questioner, and most of the time it's Liz Cheney from Wyoming, one of only two Republicans on the panel, who shows incredible discipline and actually lack of affect, which has been incredibly effective. And yes, I do have a crush on Liz Cheney now because of her ability to ask questions. And as a journalist, I really respect people who can ask concise and clear questions. Finally, the GOP decision to boycott this was a self-inflicted wound, and it also keeps the narrative really on track. You know, they're clearly regretting it now. You know, they've no chance to present the other side if there is another side, and more likely to divert what's going on. So for all those reasons, I think it's been really, really captivating. I don't know, Bob, do you feel the same way? Am I assessing it correctly?
Yeah, I think on many fronts you are, because I did not think I would be, you know, here almost on the cusp of July, still talking about these hearings for one thing. And while I thought they would be valuable for kind of a for the record account of what happened, the way in which the committee has gone about lining up its sources, and it looks like Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, might be also appearing by latest reports, if those are accurate. So that'll add further intrigue to all of this. It does also provide further insider insight, because again, the people who are now testifying, Cassidy Hutchinson and others, were people who were in the Trump administration to the end, to its final days. They were stalwarts. And yet they are feeling like they need to come forth and speak under oath about what they saw happening, the misgivings they had. I think what's going to be interesting, because you don't have the Republican sort of cross-examination going on that one might have expected, the degree to which some of this stands up or not. Maybe we can get into a little of that, Carla, which is, at the end of the day, are these hearings going to then translate into, say, further bolstering U.S. democracy, or is it still too premature? Because there is this hovering sense of accusation still coming from a number of Republican lawmakers and maybe more who might get elected in the midterms that this is nothing more than a witch hunt.
Well, certainly you're hearing a lot of the witch hunt coming out of Mar-a-Lago. You know, there are two questions. Are the hearings going to make a difference? And, you know, how do we define make a difference? Is it going to raise public alarm about the fragility of the system? It certainly has raised my sense of alarm about the fragility of the system. Is it going to lead Americans back away from the political polarization that underlines all of this? Are they going to send powerful people to jail, which and deter others from trying this again? I think those are some of the really big questions that we don't have answers about it. Right now, we have very limited indicators. We know people are watching, you know, 20 million in the first primetime hearing with a steady decline since then as they went to daytime. We don't know. We've got Nielsen, of course, for TV, but we don't know how many watching the highlights. You know, I've been watching them during the day and then making my husband watch the highlights at night. So I've been watching them a lot. You know, the polls have been asking whether people are paying attention. Those are all over the lot. So we don't know. And we don't know whether people tell the truth in those sort of polls because a lot of this is tribal. You know, what we do know is that they don't appear to yet have broken through the partisan bubble. You know, CBS had a poll, you know, in the field before Hutchinson, but just last week, you know, that they asked what happened, on the Capitol on January 6th, and 55% of the respondents described it as an attempt to overthrow the government. But of that, more than 80% of the respondents were Democrats saying that it was an attempt to overthrow. People had a choice, obviously, from this poll that they could give more than one response. 59% of those who described it as either patriotism or defending freedom, more than half were Republicans, you know, while people who gave that response, only 14% were Democrats. So clearly there's still an enormously different narrative about what happened on January 6th, which has not appeared to have been changed by these. Now, whether people really believe that or they just feel that response is the response for the team, I think something else that, you know, is really sort of chilling to look at it as part of that poll, they asked them a forward-looking question, the question of will some officials refuse to certify elections for political reasons? And, you know, 66% of the people said it was either very likely or somewhat likely in upcoming elections that we're going to have a problem with officials refusing to certify elections for partisan reasons. And that's a very, very chilling thing. So as much as this has raised the alarm, I think it's also, you know, told people that we have a really profound problem in this country that has not been resolved by these hearings.
That's well put, Carla. And at the end of the day, we're watching these political primaries play out at the same time that these hearings are, and we're seeing, you know, there's almost a scorecard of, as we go state by state, which pro-Trump candidates won for everything from, you know, county official level up onto running for Congress. And, you know, there have definitely been some candidates who are Republicans who staked independent positions and won. But there have been an awful lot of believers in the so-called big lie who won resoundingly. And I'm talking about also for running for Congress as well as running for statewide offices. And so this is all raising the question of, you know, if we're facing anything similar to what we had in the 2020 elections in terms of swing states needing to certify, is this country going to be in a position to be able to handle this? And this gets back to the so what of these hearings, I think. And the big question is if they put something on the record and enough people have misgivings, you know, can that turn the tide? The only other thing I would mention that might be interesting, Carla, maybe you find interesting as well, is to the extent to which within the Republican Party, there are calculations going on about Trump's viability / suitability to run for president again, or should he step aside for others? And others, you know, include Mike Pence, who is the subject of the president's ire at the time of January 6th.
Well, you know, so much of political coverage is horse races coverage. And, you know, we are constantly saying we shouldn't, you know, that sort of coverage shouldn't be right. Who's up, who's down, who's up, who's down. And we are watching every one of these primaries to see, is the Trump back candidate, you know, that's the latest indicator. You know, is Trump going to run? Do people dare to, you know, to split with Trump? We don't know yet. We really don't know yet. And interesting, internationally, you know, we're trying to figure out what the international reaction to this. I mean, that's the biggest question that people keep asking me. I mean, Bob, you talk to a lot of our friends who were in the press internationally. I mean, they're watching this very closely. People were certainly horrified. There was a really interesting, you know, Pew poll right after January 6th that said people don't, you know, they have doubts about American democracy because we're so profoundly polarized. And certainly when I talk to my friends in the foreign press who are paying attention to these hearings, they're not saying what I was saying in the beginning of this, which is, isn't this great that you guys at least can have people come up and tell the truth? What they're saying is, oh my God, you know, you guys are a hell of a lot weaker than we ever expected. And is Trump coming back? Yes, Joe Biden is there. He's at the G7. He's at the NATO. He's taking a really strong lead on Ukraine. Is Trump coming back? And, you know, these hearings certainly, you know, are roiling those feelings internationally. You know, what does it mean? Which leads us to the next question. You know, is anyone going to pay a price for January 6th? And does that have a deterrent value? Because we, you know, we tend to believe that, you know, legal processes in theory have some sort of a deterrent value. And that comes back to the, you know, is Trump going to go on trial? Are the people around him going to go on trial? What's the Justice Department doing? And is the committee going to make a referral? I think we got to keep in mind that what the Justice Department is doing and what the committee are doing are completely separate to a certain extent. I gather to the neuralgia of the Justice Department right now, you know, what we're reading, you know, the Times is reporting today that justice officials only learned what Cassidy Hutchinson had to say this, you know, the same way the rest of us did by watching her on TV. But justice has been doing its work all along. You know, it's so far it's been focusing on the rioters and brought some 840 criminal cases on charges ranging from misdemeanor trespass to obstruction of a congressional proceeding to seditious conspiracy. The prison sentences have been pretty light, except for people who attacked law enforcement officers that day. And we've yet to see what happens with the prosecution of the alleged organizers, you know, these members of this far-right extremists, you know, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, a total of 16 members, including the Proud Boy leader Enrique Tarrio and the Oath Keeper founder Stuart Rhodes, have been indicted on this charge, you know, seditious conspiracy, which I went and looked up, Bob, because I do my homework for you.
Thank you.
For a Civil War era charge defined as when two or more people in the U.S. conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the U.S. government, or to levy war against it, or to oppose by force and try to prevent the execution of any law. And if convicted, it's 20 years behind bars, apparently. So, you know, that seems like a much bigger deal, but that has been postponed. I think those trials have been postponed because of what's now going on with the committee. So that seems the biggest thing so far that justice is looking at. And we don't know if they're looking at Trump and all. They have been moving up the food chain in recent days. You know, there have been warrants and subpoenas going on, including to this guy, Jeff Clark, who was saying, you know, we learned in the previous hearing, was saying, just make me attorney general and I'll make it all happen. The fake slate of electors, as well as John Eastman, the lawyer who was telling President Trump that was the way to go. So they seem to be moving someone up the food chain, but that, you know, we don't know how far they're willing to go. And basically with justice, no president has ever been charged with a crime since he left office. There are plenty of crimes that the legal scholars have been looking at that have come up in these hearings, potentially obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the United States, seditious conspiracy, again, wire fraud, incitement to riot. And now in this last hearing, you know, potential of witness tampering. So there's lots of potential out there. I think in the end of the day, it's going to be a political decision whether they decide to charge the president. Whether the committee makes a criminal referral, there seems to be some disagreement inside the committee on that, but that's a political decision as well. And ultimately really doesn't matter because it's not binding on justice. I think the committee more than anything else is getting the information out there, but in the end of the day, justice is going to have to decide, and that's political.
So we head into a long July 4th weekend with the country sort of divided in more ways than I can recall in my lifetime, and yet a potentially galvanizing moment taking place in these House hearings. So stay tuned, I guess.
And it is, I just would like to say that, you know, for July 4th, that I may be the only one out there who feels this way, but I feel incredible pride in our country that at least, even in the worst of these times, that we can have hearings like this and that there is, you know, the astringence of truth out there, if that's a word, astringency of truth out there, that we are seeing more and more the truth of what happened leading up to that really terrible, terrible day. So, Bob, with that, I'd like to take our discussion to Hong Kong, a place where there will not be hearings like this, I fear, ever again. July 1st marks the 25th anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong from British to Chinese rule. And as part of the 1997 handoff deal, China agreed to allow the city some political autonomy. But in recent years, we've seen Beijing crack down. They've broken that promise. They've restricted democratic freedoms. They've broken heads with protests and dissent. Can you tell us the importance of this anniversary? And, you know, Xi Jinping went there today. It's the first time he's left the mainland in, what is it, 29 months since the start of the pandemic. He didn't go to the G20. He, you know, hasn't gone to meetings. He's been doing everything. He didn't go to the BRICS summit, did everything virtually. But he's there right now. What does it all mean?
Yes, Carla, it was significant that Xi made his first foray beyond the mainland since COVID descended to Hong Kong. It shows the importance of Hong Kong to him, to China asserting its control over what it has seen as wayward Hong Kong and continuing to consolidate the strengthening of its writ. I have to go back, when I think about 25 years, I have to go back to that handover period. I was fortunate enough to actually be in Hong Kong in that time period. And I remember the great sense of anticipation, but it was a positive sense in the air, whether you were talking to expats at the Foreign Correspondents Club, which I happened to hang out in, or you're talking to Chinese nationals or citizens of Hong Kong. Some were raising the notion of, well, is Hong Kong going to end up exerting its influence over China in a way that China becomes more like Hong Kong? And in fact, we've seen the exact opposite. It took 25 years before China really started cracking down with national security law and other steps. And I want to quote someone who was actually very prescient 25 years ago at a panel I went to. It's Keith Richburg of the Washington Post, who was a correspondent then and has continued to spend a lot of time in Hong Kong and writes really smart fashion about it. And he had a recent op-ed in the Washington Post where he just kind of went chapter and verse through all of the different impacts. You know, he notes that civil society has been decimated, that campus student unions have been dissolved, the giant confederation of trade unions has been disbanded, the professional teachers union, to give you a sense of the types of organizations that existed, it had 100,000 members. It's been closed down after being branded a, quote, malignant tumor by the Chinese media, and on and on. Media was vibrant. I recall the English language as well as Cantonese language and other media in Hong Kong was really active and vibrant, and had been actually for a number of years until most recent years. That's all been shuttered. A very big symbolic step was the recent removal of the statue commemorating the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. That was in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was an important site for memorializing what happened in Tiananmen Square. And so you have a sense of an end of a chapter. What's interesting, though, and I want to point once more to the Keith Richburg piece, is that he says it's not the end of Hong Kong, and you could even see this continuing as a thriving financial center because of its proximity, because of the expertise that's still there, even though you've had tens of thousands of people fleeing to places like Canada or the UK, or I think the US is also taking in some people from Hong Kong. But still in all, Richburg sees it as lasting. It's just lasting and enduring as a different kind of Hong Kong and not the kind that any of those who really cherished what it was, you know, had envisioned.
So if he believes that it's going to endure as a financial center, which is always what, you know, the Chinese wanted it to be, the financial entry. So this is, when they say one country, two systems, what they're really talking about is the financial system will remain and it'll become one very repressive Hong Kong, and it is already there. But, you know, doesn't this tell you, I mean, there's been so little world reaction. People were horrified, you know, by the protests and the crackdown. But in the end of the day, you know, China's influence is so transcendent because of its, you know, its economic power. It's remarkable how little people have objected to the way that they had a deal with the Brits and they broke it.
Yeah.
And the Brits didn't object very forcefully. And while we did, you know, object somewhat, I mean, certainly the Trump administration didn't object particularly forcefully. And I don't, you know, I think we're all, it tells you something very scary, doesn't it? About China's power and the power to sort of stomp out a democracy in what was a really vibrant place.
Yeah, and it has repercussions in lots of directions. And I would also add to your list what's been still occurring in Xinjiang in terms of the clampdown there, what has been labeled by a number of international monitors as genocide of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And you had a recent visit by a UN human rights official, the top official, Michelle Bachelet, which basically had very muted, if anything, sort of comment on the conditions there and what China has done to the Uyghurs. China resents bitterly any sort of indication that it's a human rights violator anyway. And just to harken back to our discussion about the January 6th hearings, you know, it tries to flip the table on the U.S., for example, and saying, look, you can't even protect your own, you know, capital. We're here to provide stability. And they continue to harp on this line of being a stable place in which to do business, in which to conduct societal affairs, but don't start, you know, branding them on human rights. And it's really unfortunate, back to Hong Kong, that this real beacon for freedom and free expression. I mean, it was an incredible place for free expression and for Chinese in particular. And it now also stands as a real warning signal to Taiwanese. You know, and these are different places. It's worth pointing out. Hong Kong, roughly 7 million population, seaside, you know, kind of collection of islands and ports and so forth. Whereas Taiwan, an island of 26 million, with a long now couple of generation, a tradition of independence and almost a generation of democratic independence. And looking at any sort of Chinese promises, one country, two systems, or whatever, as very hollow. And so it does resonate what is, as this anniversary plays out in Hong Kong, what it means for Taiwan, which is why a huge amount of attention is now taking place. Also vis-a-vis what Russia's doing in Ukraine, what are China's calculations on Taiwan? Xi has certainly made it clear about the desire to bring Taiwan back to the fold, so to speak, Carla. But Hong Kong stands as a real grim sort of harbinger of what that means.
So do you think that Beijing sort of calculates, you know, well, the Brits said nothing about, you know, the Brits did not manage to rally a level of international outrage about Hong Kong, and ergo Taiwan, we can probably sidestep it as well? Or do they make a distinction between a spent empire like the Brits versus crossing the United States?
I think the latter. I think that the U.S., you know, even as the U.S. continues to try to consistently articulate the clarity of its intentions in terms of defending Taiwan, the fact that the U.S. looks to be intent to defend Taiwan now, as the Biden administration has indicated, gives China pause. I think, you know, the Taiwan Relations Act is an official act of Congress that allows the U.S. to support Taiwan even while it recognizes the one China of mainland China. And so I think there's different calculations going on there. There's strategic also calculations about what a Chinese-controlled Taiwan means for the whole Pac Rim, where China has already started to assert itself in other areas. And we just had today, we should note, the inauguration of the son of Ferdinand Marcos as leader of Philippines, and he was making positive overtones towards China. If China is somehow able to bring the Philippines into its orbit, it gives it another strong presence or ability to have a strong presence in the South China Sea. So Taiwan stands as a really important aspect for that as well. And it's why it figures in U.S. calculations far differently than, say, Hong Kong did with British ones. Although it is worth pointing out the British response so far.
And we have some choices with this inauguration in the Philippines, because just before the inauguration, the Duterte government has shut down two important, you know, independent news, you know, or one important, you know, Maria Ressa's independent news organization, and has previously Rattler, shut down another one. And there's a whole question about whether Bong Bong is going to have a charm offensive and reopen them or not. But, you know, are we going to look the other way? We have a long history of looking the other way when it comes to the Philippines. And if there's a bidding war going on between the United States and China for this, you know, this government in the Philippines, I mean, shutting down Maria Ressa is, you know, an extraordinary journalist, Peace Prize winner. And what they've done, it's just a horror. And not speaking out and not speaking out forcefully on Hong Kong is of grave, grave concern. And I suppose finally, my question for you, Bob, about China, which is once again, not the Brits not rallying a particularly strong response originally. NATO, you know, in its strategic concept, has added China to the list of its concerns, which the Americans obviously were pushing very hard for. They're widening the lens even as Russia becomes, you know, once again, the main focus for NATO. You know, do the Europeans really mean that? I don't think the Ukraine lesson of the ability to organize, you know, a strong response to Russia. Russia is their primary concern. Do you think that the Europeans would organize this forcefully if Taiwan were a threat?
It's a really good question. I don't know about the Taiwan calculus. I do think that Europe has started to really recalculate from a number of signals about its, you know, the way it regards its relations with China, and the German expression Wandel durch Handel, you know, that we can exert change through commerce, is now really thrown into doubt. Certainly what happened with Russia, it seems to bear that out. You've had, you know, Italy putting it more at arm's length, its Belt and Road ties to China, and, you know, Europeans as a whole signaling concern about Chinese approach to human rights, which Europeans take very seriously, and they have all sorts of bodies set up. We've already seen you know, the way these guys have responded to Ukraine. And the Europeans, I do think at the end of the day, don't feel comfortable with just sort of looking the other way and doing business with China. Also significant at the NATO meeting in Madrid was that the Japanese and South Korean officials were invited. That's an interesting new wrinkle. You've got the U.S. dealing with the Indo-Pacific, you know, realignment, where it's trying to make more common cause with Japan and India, for example. You've had, you know, a new South Korean government now elected, trying to make a stronger common cause with the U.S. on regional security. So I think the NATO announcement aligns with the sense that the values that binds together NATO extends to other countries and extends into Asia. But, you know, we're still going to have to see the extent to which this causes China in any way to stop its current approach to its and its new assertiveness in the region.
And we'll see whether it's really values-based or security-based.
Yes.
And I think that the Philippines will be one test. And I think it's a test that we certainly failed in Hong Kong. And today's lack of celebration is an example of that. It is a tragedy.
Yeah.
So Bob, talking about tragedies, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected the more than 50 migrants who died really horrifically in Texas. Can you tell us about this tragedy?
Sure. And unfortunately, that number has ticked up in terms of the fatalities. It's now 53. They were close to, it seems, 70 or so people locked into a tractor trailer that had crossed the border in triple digit heat. The heat apparently was amplified even hotter in there. It's sort of unspeakable what those people went through, but it speaks to, one, the desperation of people to flee bad conditions or to seek out better economic conditions in the U.S. It's a real mixture. We know there were something like 20 or 22 Mexican nationals in that truck among the victims. There were Central Americans. There has been increasingly a mix of other people from the hemisphere as well as the Caribbean that are part of these flows trying to get into the United States. What is going to be interesting is whether this, and there was a great deal of concern about, you know, the trauma and just what happened to these people across the board. It also became a political football with Republicans in Texas blaming the Biden administration, turning it back on them or accusing them of, you know, sort of using this tragedy to try to gain points. In the middle of it all, just as we were taping this podcast, came a new ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court on terminating the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. And that is a policy that has kept close to 70,000, mostly Central American migrants, from entering into the U.S. to pursue asylum claims. And I say that because there is this dysfunction that has plagued U.S. Migration policy and immigration policy for years. Congress simply will not do anything comprehensive on this front. So there's been all these patchwork moves by different administrations on up through the Trump administration. The Biden administration came into office vowing to fix things. It has had a very mixed start, shall we say. Republicans, Texas Republicans in particular, accused the administration of supporting what they call, quote unquote, an open border policy. But at the same time, you know, Republicans have blocked efforts to try to create an expanded asylum and refugee policy, at least in the ability to process legitimate claims, of which there seem to be regrettably a larger number. So, Carla, that's a complicated way of saying this tragedy has some of its roots in a very dysfunctional U.S. system, as well as obviously the conditions in the source countries of these migrants that were bad enough to force these people to follow this route. And it, unfortunately, it is likely to continue for some time.
And because there's, you know, this is one of these mismatched policies in which you're not going to resolve the push, you know, pull issue. People are going to want to leave until there's economic development. And, you know, the climate change issues are going on. I mean, that's the work of decades. And, you know, and the terrible violence and all these things that force people out, that they want their children to have better lives, the same way all of us are the children of migrants, you know, in the first place, unless we're Native Americans and indigenous. And that's the work of decades. And so the midterms come every 2 years anyway. So it's just this terrible. I do remember a time when Republicans, you know, there were serious Republicans who sponsored, you know, immigration reform, but those days are long gone. So,
and at the very least, supported the refugee policy that kept refugee levels roughly 80 to 100,000 a year. It was one of the biggest ones in the world, and it was just severely scaled back under the Trump administration.
No, and this is just a horrifying, horrifying reminder. And of course, much like the gun debate, this will be a call for more security rather than a call for rational, humane policy. That is just really a tragedy.
One other thing I would add, Carly, is we have a new piece that we put up on CFR.org, which is a very photo-heavy journey that many migrants make, an increasing number make, through what's called the Darien Gap, which is this very perilous, heavily jungled crossing, connects Colombia with Panama. It shows what's at stake in these journeys. These are people who, many of whom are intent on reaching the U.S. border, many, many miles distant. But they start out by coalescing and gathering in Colombia and then plunging into this Darien Gap. And then they emerge in Panama and then start this really long, arduous trek. It's another way of sort of looking at the human side of this whole saga.
Well, thanks for that, Bob. I will look for that. That's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. As Bob said, Bongbong Marcos takes office as the new president of the Philippines, and we will see whether he is less repressive than his predecessor. Switzerland's legalization of same-sex marriage goes into effect. Remarkable it took that long. And the G20 foreign ministers meet in Indonesia.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They really help us get noticed and improve the show. Any articles, books, or podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seawert with senior producer Gabrielle Sierra. Rafaela did double duty and engineered this episode. Thanks, Ralph. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and thanks again, Carla, for joining us.
And this is Carla Robbins saying so long, and I hope you invite me back.